This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Su An. We are back with our brainwave segment in March. And as always, joining me today is neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar. How are you doing today, Dr. Azlina?
I'm good. Thank you so much. How are you?
Doing good as well. You know, it is now March, but it is still fairly early in the month. And, you know, we thought we'd like to take this chance to observe World Rare Disease Day, which is usually celebrated on the last day of February every year. So that was last Monday on the 28th of February. So, you know, and while rare diseases are rare, there are around 10,000 different types of rare diseases. And I guess collectively, you know, this adds up to a large number of people, even if each individual rare disease only affects a small number of people. Now, with more than 80% of these rare diseases having underlying genetic causes, it means that it's especially important for us to identify these genetic factors, right? So that doctors, healthcare professionals can get the right therapy and treatment to the people living with these distinct disorders. And yet, at the same time, you know, Dr. Azlina, we've done quite a number of shows. You've done quite a number of shows on your segment with other people who have rare diseases. And it's not uncommon for us to hear about this diagnostic odyssey that many in the rare disease community go through just to get a diagnosis. So today we want to find out more just how far we've come in identifying these genetic causes of rare diseases, as well as how we can do better in this area. But I guess before we get to how it's done today, Dr. Azlina, let's take a look back in history, right, to understand how far we've come. What was the earliest or perhaps most significant genetic discovery when it comes to these rare genetic diseases that led to where we are now?
Yeah, so thanks to Anne for doing the show. I think it's important to mark Rare Disease Day as much as possible. And we should be talking about rare diseases a lot to help to raise awareness. So going back to the question about how we find genes, so the easiest way to do it is by working with large families. Mm-hmm. Right? So families where you have multiple affected family members and they all have the same clinical features, so that we can sort of be sure that whatever is causing the disease, it's probably the same thing, right? Because they all the symptoms that they get are all the same. Okay. So actually one of the best success stories for this is the Huntington's disease gene. And that was actually done in together with many families in Venezuela, actually. So it was led by researchers from the US, and it was actually led by a person, Nancy Wexler, who had herself a family history of Huntington's disease. And she was really keen in sort of understanding more about the genetics. So she found that there were these, there was an isolated population that was being stigmatized because of the symptoms of Huntington's, because in Huntington's disease, it's a neurological disease where mm-hmm. the individuals, they have these sort of like uncontrollable movements. So this population, unfortunately, was sort of shunned, and they all lived, you know, apart from the rest of the community. And because of that, then there was a lot of intermarriage happening within that population, which then also helped to increase the numbers. Right. As we know, if you marry or have children with people who are closely related to you, then the chances are that, you know, you may have subsequent generations will also carry that trait. So by working with these families, and now actually they've over 18,000 samples, right, which is an amazing resource. Initially, how they did it was, I won't go into the details, but they were able to locate the likely location of the gene on a specific chromosome. And in this case, it was on chromosome 4, right? But then, although they knew where the problem was, but they didn't actually know what the gene was. They sort of had a kind of postcode. We know that it's here. But even that was enough for them to be able to start offering genetic testing to other family members And then over the period of 10 years, because of certain technology, new technology that became available, they then were able to identify the mutation in the gene, in a particular gene, which we now know as the Huntington's gene. So they eventually found the gene in 1993, but they had found the original location on chromosome 4 in 1983. So it took them 10 years. So if you compare that with what we're able to do now, actually, once we get the DNA sample from the patient and we get a good kind of clinical history and family pedigree, et cetera, and then we can send it off using newer technology to screen their DNA, actually, we're able to find the likely gene within, 3 to 4 months, really. And in the cases where the gene is already known, we just need to screen to see whether or not that patient has a mutation in the already known gene, then that's a lot faster. So with technology, it's getting a lot easier to do it. And you can actually see in terms of the number of publications that have been coming up, the number of studies that are now identifying, new genes for such and such disorder is just been on such an increase in the last 10 years. And that's because of this new technology.
Let's talk about that new technology in a bit, right? But first, you were talking about how with Huntington's, for example, they were able to study a large group of family members, right, who had the who had presented with all the symptoms. So I guess that would that mean that usually, what we see is that rare diseases which are genetically hereditary or rare diseases that affect multiple family members, are those then easier to identify and diagnose compared to perhaps non-inherited ones, or in cases where we see family members only having one child being affected?
Yeah. Yes, so generally it's easier when you work with larger families. So one thing that sometimes I sort of talk to medical students and I teach them, a little bit about how we find genes. And I always tell them, if you come across a patient in clinic and they tell you about, it's a little bit like, breast cancer as well. Breast cancer and ovarian cancer and cervical cancer, you tend to see, multiple affected family members. So same principle that you would apply if a patient comes to you and they tell you, their other sibling is also affected and their mother or their father or their uncle or their grandfather, that's really valuable information. And so we would take a record of that and we would draw out their family tree and take note of who is affected and who is not affected. And by using that information, that starts to give us some clues as to where the gene could be. So for example, if it has any kind of indication that it could be related to a gender. So, if in the family across a number of different generations, you only see it in a boy, and that boy is affected in the males, and the males are affected quite early in life, then that tells you that it could be an X-linked disorder. If you see it, say, in a mix of males and females, and it happens almost every generation, then that tells you that it's probably not on a sex chromosome, so it's on the other chromosomes, what we call the autosomes. And that sort of then helps us understand how it's being inherited. And also other things, for example, we take note of the age of onset. So when the symptoms begin to appear in the different individuals, for certain types of changes in the DNA, that age will be fairly stable. So for example, if the uncle had it around 40, then another family member would also have it around 40. But they are in some cases, like in Huntington's, in some cases of Huntington's, you see in subsequent generation, the age gets younger and younger. And so that's also another kind of clue to tell us that, there's a specific type of mutation that we should be looking for. So kind of after getting all this really valuable information about the families, then you sort of take their DNA. Most of the time we use blood. Sometimes we can also use saliva. And then we send it off for more extensive genetic screening. And then after that, then we get the results back, and then we try to piece the puzzle together. So that's the part that's quite fun to do as a scientist. Sort of, you know, you want to understand and you want to get answers, you know, that would be meaningful for the family. And of course, you know, try to understand the disease further in the hope that we can understand, you know, the pathways that lead to what's causing problems in the cells. So it's also possible to work with families where there's only one affected individual. And so in those situations, it's really valuable to get DNA from the parents, because then we can understand what's happened in the child. So sometimes what we find with the rare diseases is that, the parents will come and they will say that, well, you know, there's nobody else in my family on either side of the family that has this disorder. And they just, it's never even occurred to them that they could be carriers, right? And one of the reasons for that is that nowadays we're having sort of smaller families, right? The way the genetics is sort of transmitted is that, you know, for certain types of rare diseases, only 25% of your children may develop the disease. So sometimes if, you know, in a small family, you only have one or two children, those children may not have inherited that genetic, the two copies that would cause the disease. But then every now and again, you know, it just by chance, the gametes, the egg of the sperm that carries that abnormal copy, those are the ones that combine, and then you will have a child that has the disease. So even though sometimes the parents will say that they don't have a family history, but sometimes you will see that they have that they are carriers. Other kind of really other important clues that we also look at in smaller families is whether or not the parents are closely related. So that also increases the chances that they may carry the abnormal gene. So by looking at the sort of smaller families, we can still do the same type of analysis that we would do with the larger families. The only problem is that we would need to wait for either another family to be found that we can screen our candidate gene, let's say, you know, because we want to report, or we want to show that other families also have the same genetic cause. Alternatively, if it's very difficult to find other families, then sometimes we have to do some work on the cells. We have to do some other experimental work to show definitely that the changes that happen to the DNA is likely to be the one that's causing the actual disease. So for people that we call gene hunters, or, you know, geneticists who are looking for the genetic causes of these rare diseases, we try to do the as much as we can, right? And actually, if you look at in terms of the publications, the majority of the publications that came out in the late 1990s and in the 2000s was studies that were working on these large families, but then these smaller families were the ones that were really kind of like, we don't really know what we can say about them, because we have a candidate, but we can't really say much. But then now with these sort of more recent technologies, we're able to more fully explore these smaller families. And so now we're able to solve a lot more. And that kind of the rate of gene discovery is now on an increase again.
Let's go for a quick break now, Dr. Azina. And when we come back, you know, let's talk about how technology has advanced as to where we are today, how timelines have been shortened. I'm speaking today to neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar for her monthly Brainwave segment. And we are looking at how rare disease genes are identified in conjunction with World Rare Disease Day, which was observed last Monday on the 28th of February. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. Joining me today is Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, neurogeneticist, for her brainwave segment, and we are discussing the process of identifying rare disease genes. You know, earlier we started by talking about what really started it all with the study and research into the Huntington's disease, and how they it took them over 10 years to discover the gene. And Dr. Azlina, you mentioned earlier that, you know, nowadays we're seeing the timelines being much shorter. You said 3 to 4 months. I guess what are some of the technologies or advancements that have led us to this point where the timelines are much shorter? It's taking months and not years.
Right. I mean, it's a combination of factors. Number one is that the actual technology to read the DNA is getting better. And it's getting cheaper to do. So if you compare when the whole genome project, which was basically the same thing, we wanted to read everybody, you know, the whole book, you know, the whole genome, that costs something like 1 billion. But nowadays, in terms of ringgit, we can actually send off a sample for about 15,000 to 20,000 for whole genome sequencing. So I know there may be some companies that are actually offering to do it for cheaper than that, but mm-hmm. In a kind of research or clinical setting, the price can be a little bit more because the technology that we prefer to use gives us a lot more depth, and it kind of helps us to screen it in better detail and better resolution so that we can be sure that we haven't missed anything, right? So at the moment, it's plateaued. It sort of stopped around 15 to 20,000 for the last 5 years or so. And that is to be able to read the entire, like all the whole book. We're trying to read the whole book, right? But there is also other types of technology that we can also use if we want to get fairly quick results as a first pass, let's say, the first stage of screening. And that is where we know, right, that in our DNA, let's say I've used this sort of analogy before. So our DNA has around, each of us has around about 3 billion letters, right? So, and these letters come in a combination of 4 nucleotides, so A, T, G, and C. So it's in, they come in different combinations, and that we have 3 billion of them. Approximately in everybody's genome, okay? But out of that 3 billion, there are only certain parts that actually make proteins or other functional elements that actually do the workhorse in the cell. And so research has shown that for about 85% of these genetic disorders, that the problems are going to happen in this sort of small portion here. And that portion is only really about 2 to 3% of our entire DNA. So if you imagine your DNA is a 300-page recipe book, okay? Mm-hmm. And just like any recipe book, not every page will have recipes, right? There will be certain pages where it's blank, other pages where it's just kind of, you know, whatever, introductory. But there will be some pages which have the recipes. So same thing with our DNA. So in that 300-page book, only about 6 to 9 of those pages will actually carry the recipe for making this protein or other functional components of our cell. Okay. And so the majority of the, so 85% of mutations have been found in this 6 to 9 pages. So if we wanted quick answers, normally we just send the DNA and we ask the companies, well, just look at the 6 to 9 pages. And then I want to look at the results from that first. Okay. And so that is quite easy to interpret. In terms of timeline, you could probably get the result back in about 6 to 8 mm-hmm. weeks even. And then after that, then we would then do a number of steps, okay, to remove any changes that are not likely to be causing the disease. And then if we have other family members, we then use We then compare against the other family members to see, you know, in the affected individuals, which ones are shared. And then from there, then we will, most of the time we have a list of probable suspects, maybe about five genes or so. And then from there, we will do a little bit more work. So that's kind of generally how we would do it. With whole genome sequencing, let's say we wanted to ask the company to read, I want to read the entire 300-page book. Obviously, to do that, the technology takes longer. So usually, and then when we get the results back, it also is a little bit more complicated in terms of the analysis. But generally, right, you would end up, okay, and people would be surprised. And I originally, when I started doing this work, I was also really surprised that you could go from something like having a report that says, well, your patient has 50,000 changes in their DNA, okay? And then you filter it down using a number of different methods, okay? So you remove, and then you end up with maybe about 50, you know? So you go from 50,000, you go down to 50, and then you do a little bit more analysis, and then you may end up with 10, then a little bit more analysis, and then you may end up with, you know, a handful. So that's kind of the process that is taken. And then after that, once we identify a most likely gene, right, that we think is causing the disease, then what happens is the longer kind of verification and validation where we need to prove to the scientific community that when you change this part of the DNA, then that is what causes the disease. So in terms of sort of finding genes, the finding candidates or likely suspects has become fairly straightforward. But for us to then translate it into something meaningful for the patient, that part takes much longer, because ultimately, right, if we find a gene that implicates a new process or a new pathway in the cell, then potentially that could mean that, oh, that's a new target that we can develop a therapy for, right? But we need to be sure that that is definitely the process that's happening, and we need to identify, okay, which is the best target that we need to focus on in order to develop the drugs, right? So there's going to be, inevitably, there's going to be a lag in between, you know, the researchers publishing, you know, genes that they have identified for certain genetic disorders and finding a therapy or a cure, because that part now is going to take much longer. Just like, you know, if you look at the Huntington's disease gene, it took them 10 years to find the actual change. But then even now, 30 years later, right, 20 or 30 years later, they're only just accumulated enough information about what that change does to the cell, and in order to be able to develop significant therapies to try to reduce the effect of that protein. So you know, finding the gene is one thing, but then the longer journey is to actually work on the functional part.
Now, Dr. Sina, that's on the part of the scientists, right, or the researchers, the work that they put into that. But on the other hand, on the patient side, we often hear of this term diagnostic odyssey coming up, referring to how challenging, long and arduous that process can be for people living with rare diseases just to get a definite diagnosis, or even in some cases, many people still don't have a diagnosis. So then what's the mismatch on the other end? You know, why has it always been so difficult for people with rare diseases to get a diagnosis?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, sometimes because it's rare, number one is that perhaps it's been misdiagnosed. And then if you misdiagnose a condition, then you won't do the appropriate genetic testing. So you look for something else and then they come out as negative and you go, oh, okay. You know, then the sort of the journey stops there, right? Another thing as well is that for some of these, the rarer of the rare, the researchers may have suspects, okay? But they, like I said, they don't have other patients to be able to validate it in. So we're also quite wary in sort of claiming something, you know, when we don't have enough supportive evidence to be able to back that up, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes... So it's a combination. So it's a combination of things. Other things is that also the underlying cause, the actual change that's happened in the DNA, is a little bit more complicated. So when I talk about changes, there are varying degrees of changes that can happen. There's some that are easier to pick up, and there are others that require a lot more in-depth analysis. So. You know, if you look at the studies, right, that have been published, the most of the studies that have been published up to date are the ones that are the low-hanging fruit, the easy to identify ones, right? Mm-hmm. And then now what we're doing is we're trying to, okay, for example, let's say you have a genetic disorder and we know there are four genes that are commonly associated with that disorder. Okay, mm-hmm. So when we have a patient coming in, and then we will screen that patient for the four initially. And then if that patient has a change in any of those four, then we can sort of say, okay, well, that's solved. We think that we found the cause, the genetic cause for that patient. But mm-hmm. but still, for quite a large number of the patients that we're seeing, even after screening, that the most common four causes, right, we don't find anything at all. And then we need to do the longer. Now we need to read the whole book, right? And some parts of the book we're not able to read yet because of the certain limitations of technology. So mm-hmm. so. In the case of a person who has been screened for that initial panel of genes and then they're still negative, and then when we screen for the more extensive genetic screening, and then if they're still negative, we would then go on to do more extensive analysis. So it does take time because the technology is also kind of not there to be able to pick up the really difficult parts, the really difficult changes. And so that's why they are sort of, you know, even within a particular rare disease, you may have pockets of patients who have been genetically diagnosed, but others who are still kind of like, I really don't know what the change is in my DNA yet, you know. So that's quite common. Yeah.
So then that brings me to another point that we had discussed before the show, right? That there was a recent study conducted in the NHS in the UK, I understand, that had found that the development of a simple DNA test could detect underlying genetic causes for a number of neurological diseases and possibly ending that diagnostic odyssey that many patients have had to go through. I mean, to a layperson like me, it sounded like it was quite significant from how it was reported. But what about for people like you who are in the field? You know, tell me more about the study and whether I guess something like that is relevant here in Malaysia.
Yeah. So when you first shared that with me and I had a look and I thought, oh, you know, what is the simple DNA test? And actually, the simple DNA test that they're talking about is not really that simple. it's actually reading the whole book, right? Reading the entire 300 pages. It's actually part of an initiative that's happened in the UK called the 100,000 Genomes. Okay, mm-hmm. So where they collected patients who had unusual forms of cancer or rare genetic disorders and also some infectious diseases. And they said, okay, we're going to we're going to sequence their genomes, right? Read the whole book. And we're going to identify the changes that have happened. So, and what this study came out with was that they, you know, I was talking about these within a one rare genetic disease, you will have certain individuals that can be genetically diagnosed and then others that are still, you know, unknown, right? Mm-hmm. So they were talking about these unknowns that now by reading the entire book, we can now discover what's going on with these unknowns. Now, the way the media wrote it was that it makes it sound as if, oh, it's going to be applied or able to be applied, you know, across the board. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. it's not quite there yet, because we're mm-hmm. still at this moment, we still don't really know everything about our DNA, you know, how our DNA changes over time. And, you know, there's some regions in our DNA that we just haven't even been able to read. So for example, you imagine you have the recipe book and there's some pages in there that are glued together, right? And mm-hmm. and you just can't get at it. And so, you know, it could be that some of the underlying genetic causes could be in these sort of pages that are stuck together, right? So in terms of technology, we are able to read the book, right? Mm-hmm. But by reading that book, we may identify up to 100 spelling mistakes, okay? Mm-hmm. And which of those spelling mistakes actually caused you to get the disease? That is going to be difficult to get that final answer. So the 100,000 Genomes Project is an interesting kind of initiative because it's kind of research-based, but it's also very closely linked with the patients. So they do sort of share the results with the patients, whatever they find. But in reality, the research field, even if, let's say, I have identified 4 typos, right? But in terms of ethics, I can't yet disclose that to the patient, right? Because number one, I can't say for sure, right, which one of those is really causing the disease. And it may kind of cause other knock-on effects, right? And for example, right, the person will say, oh, okay, well, then I want to screen, you know, my siblings want to be screened or my children want to be screened to see whether or not they're likely to develop the disease. But I can't say for sure that any of those 4 is actually going to be the responsible, you know, the criminal, right? Mm-hmm. So what if then, let's say the daughter gets screened and then she finds that she has that change and then that causes anxiety in her. So until the researchers are 100% sure that this is the one that we need to screen in the family, usually we can't disclose those results. So there is this kind of like a little bit of a lag in terms of the science. And I think that's something that, you know, I think some organizations are sort of looking at. They're looking at what we call a democratization of a patient's genetic information. So a patient, if they give their DNA for research, they also have a right to be able to ask to see the results even, but they must understand that, you know, some of those results are inconclusive. You know what I mean? And I think that's actually really important as well for the patient to have access to that and, you know, not feel as if, you know, the researchers or the doctors are sort of holding on to that data. And I support, you know, if there's going further discussions in that sort of area, I think we do need to involve the patient groups more.
Mm. It's such a complex issue, isn't it? It's not just simply, okay, this is what I found, this is what you need to know, but you need to make sure that patients and their families understand all the potential ramifications. So you don't want to, like you say, you know, make them overly worried about something that that scientists are not sure yet about. So then if we come back, you know, to wrap up, right, looking at the Malaysian landscape, when it's talk about identifying rare disease genes or screening patients for genetic rare diseases, what does the landscape look like? You know, what are perhaps how far have we come, or what are the gaps that you still see?
So the doctors are getting a lot more are a lot more aware about testing, genetic testing that is available commercially. There are actually a number of companies that offer screening, this sort of initial, you know, the 6 to 9 pages that I was talking about. So we can get quick answers quickly. For some, it may come at a cost, but actually it is not too bad. For some companies, it can be about 1,000-1,005 ringgit, and you can get an answer. So what happens then is that for some patients who have had this initial screening and that are still negative, then they will then be followed up in research groups by people who are interested in understanding identifying other genetic causes for that particular disorder. So in Malaysia, it's sort of the first genetic testing step will be between the doctor and the patient to see how that happens. And then after that, then the researchers then come on board to find these other genes. And then to find these other genes, of course, then depends on the funding that is available. But actually, now as well, there's a lot of global consortiums. So some doctors, even, you know, if they're very driven to help their patients but they don't have research fundings, actually you can sign up, okay, with the patient's consent, of course, sign up to contribute the patient's sample to a large global consortium that has a lot of money to be able to do this screening. And that kind of accelerates the discovery process better.
Mm. So are you, I guess, optimistic that things will move more rapidly to improve the situation for people living with rare diseases?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, like I said, you know, the number of publications that have come out in the last 10 to 15 years has been really exponential. And then now as well, you know, scientists are developing even better tools for us to understand those that are still, you know, we've looked everywhere, but we can't find anything. What about these pages that are stuck together? Can we now start looking at them? So we're going to be able to know more and more. So for the Malaysian landscape, I think what would be really useful is if there's some concerted effort to sort of maybe come up with a centralized kind of system or a particular unit, you know, that handles this. And because, you know, reading these genetic sequences requires skilled people. And one of the things that we're lacking in Malaysia is that, you know, we're not lacking the enthusiasm of the rare disease community, but we're sort of lagging behind. We're letting them down in terms of the infrastructure that we have, right? And so we need to build up the local mass of researchers that are going to be able to work and solve these diseases better. So you know, I'm hopeful that that in Malaysia, the Malaysian rare disease community is a really fantastic resource, and I would encourage the doctors who are interested in studying rare diseases, as well as the rare disease support groups, to sort of really look out for opportunities by international consortiums at the moment and learn from them, and then see how we can then apply that to Malaysia.
All right, thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Azlina.
Okay, thank you.
I've been speaking to neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar for her Brainwaves segment, and we've been discussing identifying rare disease genes, as well as how far we've come in shortening, if not ending, the diagnostic odyssey that many people living with rare diseases and their families have to go through. I'm Nim Suan, and this has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.